For the past 20 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been dedicated to giving you the best content. From a diverse mixture of music and spoken word programs to art reviews and current news affairs, what started out as a music club is now a campus community radio station. So in this spirit, we would like to show our gratitude to all those who have been a source of inspiration and positivity which has made these 20 years colorful, fun, and full of success. CJSF. Diverse. Independent. Yours.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I'll be hosting a show on progress. What that means as a human ideal from the philosophical perspective. Today I am joined by my co-hosts, Hale Rottery and Brandon Brownlee. We've been going through an article on the ideas of progress, philosophies of progress, basically throughout human history from a Stanford article. So we started with overall conceptual issues, did some work on pre-Enlightenment thought and Enlightenment thought, and we wrapped up with 19th century views on progress last session, and now we're being introduced to some criticisms of the doctrine of progress. If the 19th century is the high watermark of progress narratives, the following period is an era of critics. In general, criticisms of the doctrine of progress fall into two categories. The first category contains straightforward denials of the claim that the human condition is improving. The second category consists of condemnations of the doctrine of progress on skeptical grounds. Consider the first group of criticisms. If the human condition is not improving, either circumstances are getting worse, or they are fluctuating between some upper and lower bound. Each alternative is certainly arguable. Horrific human catastrophes, such as genocide, wars, and environmental destruction of the 20th century, can bolster the argument that things are getting worse. But less dramatic evidence, like increasing alienation in industrialized societies, could be cited in support of the same claim. Then there are those who emphasize the natural limits that will keep the human condition within certain bounds. Either the natural environment or human nature could place limits on improvement and, for that matter, on deterioration. The previous criticisms take for granted that it makes sense to speak of the human condition as improving or declining, but one can question whether these statements are truly coherent. To vindicate such sweeping claims, it must be possible to construct an ordering of past, present, and future states of affairs. But in reality, it is sometimes difficult, even in the case of individuals, to say whether changes have been improvements or not. Consider the person who is forced to reflect and regroup after a mild setback. In the period immediately after the setback, the person is less content but acting with greater autonomy. To evaluate the change in the person's state, we must treat the values of being content and being autonomous as commensurable. And some will argue that they are not. Evaluating a change in an entire society involves the same kinds of difficult comparisons, plus a whole collection of additional ones based on distributive concerns. For instance, if a society becomes wealthier and less egalitarian over time, is this an improvement or not? Finally, even if we think a complete ordering of states of affairs is achievable, we might question the use of dialectical accounts to justify violence and catastrophes. Why should we be reconciled to a violent war just because it's at the stage for institutional improvement? Other skeptical arguments point to the difficulty of inferring broad historical laws from available evidence. In pursuit of a universal history, most theorists refuse to create a priori accounts and instead rely on empirical inferences. It is possible to attack the grounds on which theorists infer trends from past and present social phenomena. For instance, it is a mistake to equate the temporal and spatial distance. Theorists sometimes use contemporary reports of America or Africa to draw conclusions about an earlier time in Europe, or they take what they know about their own history and make assumptions about, quote, primitive, unquote, societies, based on that information. Finally, if one accurately captures a trend, it is difficult to extrapolate into the future. If we view humans as free, as long as institutional arrangements leave room for choice, the future is not entirely predictable. All of these arguments appear in the writings of critics of progress. Providing a comprehensive survey of the critics is beyond the scope of this article. Instead, the next section will treat a few of the important authors who reject the doctrine of progress, as well as one who attempts to revive it. Not all of the critics are considered pessimists. One may point out the possibility of a bright future while emphasizing that it is up to humans to choose it. And one of the things that I was most surprised about going through this series is the surprising links between theories of progress and philosophers, famous philosophers. For instance, Immanuel Kant created an idea of a system to create world peace that was based off of a federation of republics, republics being a political system that guarantees the rights and freedoms of individuals. Just to take that complex idea and say it in a few sentences. What do you think, Hale? Do you have any comments on what we've been talking about so far?
Yeah, I was just kind of absorbing what you were saying. You know, my head immediately goes to when we talk about progress in the abstract, yeah, as this overarching thing, is it really an anthropocentric like narrative construction, right? Like a way of understanding our own history? Is it really something that we can kind of step outside of and say, oh yeah, like there's this thing, it's called progress, it's moving in the right direction, it's moving in the wrong direction, it hasn't really been moving anywhere for a while. And what does that really mean? Obviously, I think that especially for us, you know, in our current world, we have a tendency to think that we're in an era of great progress. And there's some, as you kind of mentioned earlier, a lot of people think about this empirically, and there is some empirical reasons to think that might be the case. And one is obviously just looking at history itself. And what I mean by that is, like, recently I've gotten into kind of studying slash history anthropology of like much earlier sorts, like Neolithic, Stone Age, Bronze Age, human societies, those sorts of things. Basically, what you see is a long, long, long history that's barely understood, obviously, where things were pretty much the same for everyone for eons and eons and eons. And then you have this, I think a lot of people would like to think of it as a curve upwards, where really in the last few thousand years, and especially in the last 500 years, and especially in the last 200 years, and some would even say, especially in the last like 50 years, things have just changed dramatically. Are we thinking about progress in an ethical sense, really, or a moral sense, or kind of a societal range? Or are we thinking about it more in terms of like, oh, stuff's changing? Because those are two obviously very different things. You know, it's one thing to say like, yeah, obviously stuff is changing a lot, and it's changing a lot more than ever used to. But I think it's a lot more difficult to say, oh, things have gotten better. Materially, sure. And sometimes I feel naive kind of saying that, because it's kind of like, okay, well, like, I, you know, obviously the opponent comes in and says, oh, would you like to live in the Neolithic world? You know, and I probably wouldn't want to be cast into the Stone Age. I don't think I would do very well there. But I don't really think that's a fair comparison, because I'm not a person from that world, right? And it's also fair to ask, like, would someone who lived in that world, walked through that place, understood things in terms of that, you know, web of references that's so hard to grapple with, would they want to transition to here either? And also, too, the other thing that came to my mind, I'll finish off with, is in what sense does our progress and stability related, right? Again, thinking about cultures long since past, you know, our whole situation, we have a hard time recognizing how, what a sliver it is on the grand scale, even just human existence, but talk about the more modern era, right? And when you start to look back at the nomadic and early agrarian societies and these sorts of things, you see cultures and communities that were very, very stable for enormous amounts of time. And that is not actually something we can say about us. Like, we don't know if that's going to be the case. And so is that also a mark of progress? Like, they might not be as big and bright and in some ways crazy and complex, but they were able to exist, thrive, and survive for massive amounts of time. And that is very impressive.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of components when you're constructing a narrative of progress. The three main components that we've considered on this show in the past have been the social, societal component, the historical component, and the technological component. Now, when it comes to technology, that one is fairly easy in terms of saying, well, yes, we know technology has improved over time. Has the use of technology improved? Are we better at using technology for achieving actual good things? Is technology used for good purposes? That's kind of the moral, ethical, societal question. And that's a little bit more uncertain. And then historically, it's interesting because we see that humans have lived on this planet in many different ways, in many different cultures, in many different societies. And so there's definitely been development and changes and increases in complexity. But whether or not we consider that to be progress, as in incrementally better or improvement, that is not quite as clear as we might like to imagine. Would you like to jump here in, Brandon, or should I continue? Up to you.
Well, there was one thing that I wanted to kind of, highlight that Hale said. There's multiple parts working this whole progress thing. Things are happening, but also other things are happening at the same time. You can have this semblance of, well, is it going great? Is it going badly? I wonder if that might just be a function of whether we want to call it history or the world or whatever it is, being a complex thing. Multiple things are happening. You can have good things happening. You can also have bad things simultaneously happening. I think this also goes to your point about the three dimensions that you raise. I think that's a good framing of it. So bearing in mind how those dimensions play on each other, their relation, I think that gives us a way of making this apparent confusion, you know, or our apparent confusion of like, are things going great? Are things going badly? It helps us to sift that and make it intelligible, I think.
We really borrow most of our ideas from progress from Enlightenment ideas. Essentially in the 19th century, which we covered on our last episode, there was a resurgence in trying to create doctrines or systems or ideas of progress with regards to modern science. That essentially didn't go incredibly well. And so I'll get into a little bit more of some 20th century critiques on 19th century theories of progress. Some of the deepest criticisms of progress were produced during and after the catastrophes and upheavals of the 20th century. Theodore Adorno, 1903 to 1969, wrote Minima Moralia, a collection of short pieces during World War II and its aftermath. The work addresses a variety of interlocking topics related to fascism, capitalism, and the war. As a German and a Jew in exile, Adorno is concerned to confront Nazism and the Holocaust. Given his intellectual background as a scholar of Hegel and Marx, this confrontation takes the shape of a critique of Hegel's philosophy of history. Recall that Hegel claims that a reflective individual who surveys the course of history will be reconciled to tragedies when he understands their contribution to progress overall. Adorno is viscerally repulsed by this notion. He notes with indignation, millions of Jews will have been murdered, and this is to be seen as an interlude and not as the catastrophe itself. Adorno attacks Hegel from two directions. First, Adorno is simply skeptical that fascism and the Holocaust can be part of an upward historical trend. Second, he points to a tension in Hegel's own thought. He notes that in the Phenomenology of Spirit, Hegel advises tarrying with the negative, which means giving the negative moments in history a full dose of philosophical attention. However, Adorno says, in practice, Hegel often moves past human evils and individual fates in a cursory fashion, hurrying toward the stage of reconciliation. Adorno proposes a new method of examining history for meaning, exemplified by minima moralia, that dwells on individual experience and catastrophe. Theoretically, Adorno reverses Hegel, asserting the whole is the false. In Minima Moralia, Adorno mentions that the writings of Walter Benjamin, 1892 to 1940, are an inspiration to him. In the Theses on History, Benjamin offers a similar critique of the Hegelian and Marxian philosophy of history. The ninth thesis perhaps speaks for itself. A Klee painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned toward the past, where we perceive a chain of events. He sees one single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed, but a storm is blowing from paradise. It has caught in his wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. This storm irresistibly propels him into the future to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress. Benjamin, 1941. Benjamin reverses the Hegelian worldview poetically, just as Adorno does so theoretically.
I don't know as much about Adorno, but I know a little bit more about Walter Benjamin, having read some pieces by him. And obviously the two were closely related to each other and related particularly in this topic. And I think that what Benjamin and to an extent Adorno point out is that the industrial mechanical age has consequences that were kind of unforeseen. And you mentioned this earlier when we were talking about science, right? Like science became the big sort of like the prime mover of progress. What science even is, you know, that's like a complicated question, but there's this thing, it's scientific, it's this method, it's this way of essentially being in the world, and it's going to help us understand things and progress in such a way that we're going to make significant improvements, real, tangible, material improvements. The problem is that science is obviously not a moral being. And I think sometimes it's held up that way, like it's like this morally righteous thing. But at the end of the day, it is, it's a method, it's a methodology, it's a perspective, it's, like I said, a way of being the world. And it can be utilized in many ways. And this is something that Benjamin points out that, you know, in his work, the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, you know, he highlights the fact that, you know, modern technologies, which are obviously steeped in, you know, birth from a scientific method and a scientific perspective, such as, you know, photography, film, print, mass media, essentially, can very, very easily be used for what we would largely consider nefarious ends or manipulations. That's like a gross simplification, obviously, and it gets more detailed than that. But I think that that's kind of circling back a little bit. The whole, and you saw this a lot in the 19th century, which you talked about in your last episode, but this idea that, oh, if basically what we're doing is steeped in science, then it's good. Right? If it's got the scientific flavor, if it's got the scientific style, it's a good thing. Right? And it's kind of pointing out that like, that's as in the 20th century, it became very obviously clear, whether it's through manipulative propaganda or mechanizing, you know, essentially mass murder, whatever it might be, human beings, that science doesn't just innately make people do good stuff.
I do think that science has, especially in the 19th century, coming off the prosperity of the Industrial Revolution, there was this idea that, you know, we've been able to produce and create a civilization of a scale that has never been, you know, created before in human history, and that essentially the enlightened ideas of philosophy that have led to developments in scientific discovery would in turn create and new enlightened ideals of human society, that we could apply the tool of science to the structure of human society and benefit from that and reap the benefits of that. Unfortunately, human societies are complex and they're not easily reducible to simple experiments. And the ethics of those experiments are heavily questionable. Essentially, whenever you say, you know, like we should treat human society from the scientific approach, you get into a very dangerous perspective of forgetting essentially the human perspective, forgetting what it is like to be a human being and to value other human beings. And if you want to suspend that for the sake of what has been called scientific inquiry, that can be very dangerous, as we saw, especially with Adorno talks about some conceptions of progress in Europe in World War II. I do want to continue with this article because I think it will just shed further light on your point, Hale. So here we go again. Decolonization presented a second occasion for rethinking of the concept of progress. In the 20 years after World War II, the European powers relinquished the vast majority of the non-European colonies still in their possession. Scholars from the former European colonies reflected on the colonial past and have noted that European apologists for colonialism claimed that it modernized the supposedly backward non-European world. In other words, the apologists situated colonialism as in a progressive narrative. Implicitly or explicitly, post-colonial critics hold that this use of the concept of progress calls it into question. So essentially here, the doctrines of progress, ideas of progress, philosophies of progress have been used to justify colonialism, and post-colonialists have sometimes rejected and critiqued narratives of progress because of this. So to continue this just a little bit more with one more paragraph, beyond this common core, the criticisms often vary. For instance, Samir Amin's study, Eurocentrism, is concerned to criticize a particular conception of progress. This conception, which he terms Eurocentrism, characterizes all major historical innovations as European. It also views capitalist democracy as the ideal social system, and colonialism as instrumental in spreading it throughout the world. Finally, Eurocentrism holds that current global economic inequality is caused by internal features of individual countries and is in principle eliminatable. Now, Amin does not reject the project of identifying macro historical movements. His reasoning is, in fact, influenced by Marxism. He seeks only to replace Eurocentrism with a truer account. To do so, he presents an alternative sketch of historical development that shines light on non-European contributions. He next argues that current global inequality is produced by international capitalism and cannot be eradicated without dismantling that system. He ends by stating that some form of socialism is the only stable and humane political system, although it is far from inevitable. That thinker was Samir Amin.
I think that the question of obviously colonization and progress gets really kind of, well, number one, it gets really sticky, it gets really thorny, but it's also one in which we've, I think in the 20th century, we really start to see a sort of skepticism, as you mentioned earlier, around progress in general, especially being highly Eurocentric, and really start to see more of a focus on deconstructing those narratives. And the most obvious point to start for, I think, a lot of thinkers, some individuals, especially people in former colonies, is obviously colonization, right? Because the Europeans, especially through the 19th and first half of the 20th century, were deeply steeped in a pro-colonial like propaganda machine, effectively, and which they then purported to the entire world, or I should really say exported to the entire world. And so I think you have a lot of people really trying to reconcile that. You know, another thing I've been kind of interested in lately, just on a very like casual basis, is post-colonial Africa and what happened, you know, with post-colonial African leaders and that, and those, all sorts of those situations. And you have a lot of leaders who were, like most of the, like, you know, especially first and second generation, like post-colonial African leaders were members of former colonial regimes of one kind or another, right? Whether most of the time, honestly, they were in the military, colonial military. But they were oftentimes sorts of bureaucracies and those sorts of things. Some of them were effective, some of them were not. But all of them had some kind of either reconciliation or reconstruction or reinterpretation of what happened and what their country or people really is now, outside of some sort of European improvement program, essentially. I think it gets, I don't know, I'm trying to think about it, but it's really difficult. But I do think, like, taking a step back and thinking about progress generally, it's a great example of where, you know, I think that colonialism from the imperial, from the Eurocentric standpoint, was a really obvious, blatant example of progress as being something really simple, right? Like, basically, we're going to improve infrastructure, we're going to improve education, we're going to improve energy resources and all these sorts of things. A lot of that was kind of, to be frank, like a fraud, basically. But that was the kind of the idea, like that these are the, if we just do these material things, if we just like basically make everyone kind of like super, well, not kind of like super European, then like the whole world is moving in the right direction. But obviously too, like, you know, as it gets deconstructed, like as I kind of hinted at earlier, like that's not actually what was happening a lot of the time, right? Like building railroads so that you can like take resources out of a country isn't exactly the same thing as like, you know, building the railroads that would be like the most effective for the people actually living there. You know, but if there's a railroad and like trains are like, you know, a symbol of progress because look at them, they like move and stuff. So I don't know. It's complicated, but it's definitely a great example of how like that reinterpretation, that deconstruction is happening and still happening today.
Something that I was listening to recently was Trevor Noah's autobiography, Born a Crime, Stories of a South African Childhood, which talks about his experience growing up in apartheid under apartheid in South Africa. And what I find interesting about that narrative is that when he talks about the people who created apartheid, he basically says, like, what they did is they took all of the ideas of like all of the ideas of creating societies based off of race from all over the world, and they combined the worst of them together to create apartheid. And when he talks about the system from his perspective in his childhood, you can see that it's a vastly different reality than anything I think we in the West have experienced. And one thing that he talks about specifically in the beginning is that essentially